From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Nearly every parent knows, and many children can remember, those books from bedtime read in a quiet pool of light.
Good night, moon. Good night, cow jumping off the moon. Good night, light and the red balloon.
Those early books, with their pictures and poems and stories, take babies by the hand and lead them into childhood, help start their picture of life and the world. This hour on Point, we look at young children's literature, picture books, Goodnight Moon, and all the rest, before and after. We've got new material out from long-gone Goodnight Moon author Margaret Wise Brown, and a study saying people of color still aren't showing up much in those books. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. When you snuggled up with your little one, what do you or did you love and want in that book? What do we seek and show in young children's literature? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today is none other than LeVar Burton, actor, director, author. He first gained fame playing Kunta Kinte in Alex Haley's Roots. He later played Lieutenant Junior Grade Geordi LaForge in Star Trek The Next Generation. But to a generation and more of Americans, he was the wonderful host of PBS's Reading Rainbow, which ran for 23 seasons and where he won 12 Emmys as host and producer. He still hosts Reading Rainbow, now a top-selling iPad app. LeVar Burton, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, what, you're off in the digital realm now. Are you still promoting books, good old-fashioned books, LeVar? Is it all iPad stuff now?
Well, no, we are still promoting books, whether they are books that are bound or books that are digital. I simply want kids to read.
Do you picture parents now sitting in that pool of light by the, I don't know, 2-3-year-old's bed reading from their iPad? Is that the idea?
Well, it is. You know, television was the medium that we used back in the 80s to promote literature to kids. If you want to reach kids today, you pretty much need to be on a mobile device, and these tablets are so engaging. I mean, there's nobody in my circle of friends that doesn't want to spend time on them, and kids are no different. So we really need to go to what I call the point of purchase, where kids are, and introduce them to the literature that they need that will help shape and form their lives.
I mean, there's no doubt those devices are everywhere now, and at a certain age, I suppose, for sure, that's where many kids are as well. But when you're talking about a infant or 1, 2, 3, 4-year-old, they're not entirely decked out and teched out at that age yet. I mean, they'll take an old paper book just as happily, maybe more happily, won't they?
Absolutely. And let me be clear, we're talking about, you know, tablets for kids at an age in an age appropriate manner. The lap experience is still what we're talking about, where a parent or an elder and a child sit and commune and share in that time-honored tradition of sharing stories. My point is that going forward, this genie is out of the bottle. We're not going to be able to put it back in. Kids are digital natives these days. All of these children have been born in a room where there was a smartphone present, and that's the first time this has ever happened in the history of humanity.
Whatever form it's in, what's your sense of all your, after all your years with Reading Rainbow, mm-hmm. of what it is that young children, I mean, we get into young adult literature and all the rest, but those babies, toddlers, preschool kids, take from the picture book in the lap? Are they learning language? Are they getting an emotional kind of feed from that interaction? What's at the heart of that very intimate experience?
You know, it's a lot that's being communicated, Tom, in those moments. One of the things we know is that children who are read to, children who are spoken to, perform much better in a school and an education situation. And there's a huge gap in America between those who come from affluent or even middle-income households and those who come from low-income households. A middle-income child has been read to on average of 1,000 hours before they get into school, and it's fewer than 100 for a child from a low-income situation. So there is great disparity, and some of what's being missed in that lack of connective time is are those things that really do speak to the human experience. It literature and the sharing of stories is as much a part of us as is breathing. And so absent those sorts of early experiences, a child is just beginning life behind the eight ball.
What do you make as a very prominent African-American who's so associated with reading and children's books about this study finding that last year, out of 3,200 children's books published, only 93 were about black people? And, you know, we've had experts coming out and saying this is a big problem when it comes to people of color, children's self-understanding, what they see in the book, not necessarily what they see in the racial coloring of their own family.
Mm-hmm. It is an issue. We can do better. I know we can do better. It's interesting, though, to me to note that hip-hop culture is the lingua franca all over this planet. And so we have in popular culture plenty of examples of people of color in television, movies, music. However, we are still lacking positive images of people of color in children's books. That's not okay.
What's that in your experience when children are reading and, you know, the pictures on the page, there's some kind of coloring to them, skin coloring to them, one way or another? How important is it when Asian or Caucasian or African-American child is looking there and that picture is like or unlike him or her? Mm-hmm. How much does it matter?
I think it matters a lot. Speaking from personal experience, I grew up in the 60s, and it was rare for me to see people of color on television. It was a big deal when Sammy Davis Jr. was on The Rifleman. It was a big deal to see Diane Carroll have her own television series, Julia, on the air. It is important for no other reason than the development of one's self-esteem to see oneself reflected in the popular culture. And at these very early ages, if a child does not see them reflected in the literature that they are exposed to, then how do we expect to continue that interest in the literary form going forward for that child?
Well, how do you explain these numbers? 3,200 books published, 93 with black people. Is that about economics? Is that just somehow it's white authors who are more likely to write and reflect themselves in their work? How do you explain it, LeVar?
You're asking me to explain.
I don't know.
I'm a publisher. You should ask the publishing industry to explain those numbers, Dom.
But you know this world. I mean, do you have a sense of a lot of would-be black children's book authors coming out and trying to be published and failing, or just less interest from that quarter?
I know that the traditional publishing world can be exclusive and exclusionary. It is one of the last bastions of the old guard industries, and we've seen massive changes happen in the way the movie and television business, the music business they've both gone through major sea changes, and I think that the way that the publishing industry is now being converted and forced to change and adopt a digital strategy of distribution is going to change those numbers as well. It's going to level the playing field and give more access to a more diverse population of authors.
Well, we'll see. LeVar Burton was host of PBS Reading Rainbow for 23 seasons. Now he's taking it digital. Joins us from Palm Springs, California. Harry is calling from Burlington, Vermont. Harry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. What do you see out there?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. Yeah. I'm a picture book artist. Done about 17 picture books and by various authors, K.T. DeMello and Sharon Creech and Dorian Cronin.
Yeah, great.
And the one book I did that gets the biggest response from kids all over the world. And I mean, Singapore, I've been to Peru and Dubai, is a book that features an African-American main character. It's called Luke on the Loose. And in fact, the book that I'm doing right now, I got the manuscript from my agent and the publisher. And I insisted that this character be African-American because there is this pervasive attitude about these picture books, where there just seems to be this lack of diversity in the main characters.
Hey, Harry, you're the artist, the illustrator. Does the manuscript come with instructions like make these people white, black, Asian, you name it, or is it up to you?
No, they don't come with instructions like that. But and I guess part of my job is, when I get the manuscript, is to be cognizant of the landscape and make those decisions, like I did with Luke and the Loose. I said this play takes place in New York City. It's a diverse place. He should be an African-American kid. It just made perfect sense to me.
Harry, we've got a break right here. I appreciate your call. We'll take it to LeVar Burton, who joins us. We're talking about reading for children. We're going to talk about Margaret Wise Brown as well. Of course, she wrote Goodnight Moon, and there is new material out from her. Poems, songs, one example behind us right here, a lullaby out of an attic trunk from Margaret Wise Brown. We'll be right back.
Sleep like a rabbit, sleep like a bear, sleep like the old cat under the chair. Sleep like a rabbit, sleep like a bear, sleep like the old cat under the chair.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about young children's books, picture books, Goodnight Moon, and all the rest, before and after, and what we seek and what we share in children's literature. LeVar Burton is with us. You know him from, knew him way back from Alex Haley's Roots, of course, from Star Trek, Next Generation, Geordi LaForge, and for 23 years, the host of the PBS show Reading Rainbow. He's now taken that digital, an iPad app in 2012, been at the top or one of the top grossing apps ever since. He joins us today from Palm Springs, California. Here's LeVar Burton last month, Black History Month, on Reading Rainbow Storytime, reading The Music in Derek's Heart, just a little bit here, written by Gwendolyn Battle Lavert and illustrated by Colin Bootman, the story of a young black American boy whose uncle, Booker T., gives him a harmonica.
Derek blew strange, wild notes. Uncle Booker T. moaned, "Slow down. Don't rush. Tadpoles don't turn into frogs overnight. Papa told me, Booker T., music is something you hear with your ears, but you've got to feel it with your heart."
Pretty good reader there for those young ones. LeVar Burton, stand by. Callers for you. Cheryl calling from Conway, South Carolina. Cheryl, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom, and hi, LeVar. Really glad that you're talking about this subject today, because I was looking for a book that I used to read my daughter 34 years ago called The Best Time of Day, and your staff was kind enough to help me find it. It's a book about a little African-American boy and his mother, and they went through the whole day together, but the best time of day was the time when his daddy came home. And that was just a beautiful story by Valerie Fournier, and I was trying to find it to recommend it to one of my young new fathers.
Cheryl, is it still in print, Cheryl? What have you learned? Is it still out there?
Yes, they found it on Amazon for me just now. I'm so excited about that.
You know, LeVar, it's interesting how people get favorites in their mind that just stay fixed there. They remember them from years and years before, and that's the one they want.
Absolutely. We form a very serious emotional attachment to the literature we're exposed to as a child.
Did you, in your years, you're still doing children's literature with Reading Rainbow now digitally. Do you push the way forward all the time, or do you build a kind of shelf of classics that you go back to again and again? Are there some who have just nailed it so well, LeVar, that, you know, they're never going to go away as great books for little children?
I think that's the brilliance of a terrific children's book. It is as relevant 10 years ago as it is today, as it will be 10 years from today.
Yeah, let's go to Matt in Nashville, Tennessee. Matt, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. Hello, Matt. Are you there, my friend?
I was just noting that I'm doing well.
Good.
I was just noting how much more quickly my son seems to learn and pick up on lots of other things based on how much we read, and specifically, he's seen, his learning to read has accelerated a lot, to the point where if I'm in a hurry or he gets to pick out whatever book we read at night. So sometimes he picks very long books that I have no interest in reading all of, right? So you skip through it because the kid's 3 and 4 and they don't know.
Yeah.
They're happy you're reading. So now I finished the book last night. He's 5 and he says to me, Daddy, you skipped a lot of words. I said, what? He says, I know the words on those pages I was reading and you didn't read all of them. So I was stuck. I had to go back and read the whole thing. I think I've worked myself into a corner by reading to him too much.
You've gone and educated your child. What have you done, Matt?
That's right. I'm stuck with it now.
Now you're stuck with it.
Great story.
Oh, that's terrific. I remember a similar thing where even very young, I think just around a year, we were reading one of the old classics to our first, skipped a word or just sort of pausing, and he filled in the word. We didn't even know. He had any idea what was going on, LeVar? How quickly this seeps into very little children.
A lot of that learning happens on an absolutely unconscious level. And that's why these early childhood experiences are so important. That lab experience cannot be duplicated with any other interaction save the conscious effort of an adult sitting with a child, giving them their attention and sharing with them that story.
What is it about very, very simple books? I mean, you've got old Mother Goose rhymes, and even simpler. You look at Margaret Wise Brown's famous Goodnight Moon. The words are so, there are so few of them, and they are so incredibly simple. What is it about that approach, you know, as opposed to, I don't know, an elaborate narrative when it comes to small children, LeVar?
I know in our own family, and we read Goodnight Moon to our daughter, Mika, every night when she was growing up. And in our family, it became a ritual. And it was part of how we put an end to the day and really moved into another phase of the day where we were really powering down and going to sleep. And I think it's the ritual aspect of a book like Goodnight Moon that makes it so powerful and gives it the lasting, the staying power that it has. It is simple yet elegant and very powerful, and a child can begin to really put a frame around the world in which they live through that little tale of this child saying goodnight to all the things that he or she knows and loves in the world.
Right there around them in their room, just out the window.
Yeah.
Margaret Wise Brown died in her early 40s in 1952, and now there's been material out there. Now we've got some of that old material published that many people had not seen before. I've got a little sample of it here. It's a book and a CD. These are poems and lullabies, a lot of them set to music. Here's Tom Prout and Emily Gary's musical adaptation of one of these unearthed, or anyway, now in our hands, Margaret Wise Brown lullabies. This is not Goodnight Moon. This is Little Donkey, Close Your Eyes.
Little donkey on the hill, standing there so very still, making faces at the stars. Little donkey, close your eyes.
Margaret Wise Brown, after all these decades, in front of us in a new way right there. Goodnight Songs is the book that's been put together with this material. A lot of it set to music, as I say. LeVar Burton, please stand by in Palm Springs, California. With us right now from New York is Leonard Marcus, children's book historian, author, critic. He's curator of a currently running exhibition at the New York Public Library across the street from the studio where he is now, called The ABC of It, Why Children's Books Matter. He's also author of a lot of books on children's literature, including Show Me a Story, Minders of Make-Believe, Randolph Caldecott, Margaret Wise Brown, Maurice Sendak, and more. Leonard Marcus, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. It's nice to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you. Just take Margaret Wise Brown and her classic Goodnight Moon as a kind of, planted flag or benchmark. What's the style that we saw there? Was she early to offer it? Did it mark a change in children's literature? How do you look at that classic work, Leonard?
Well, she was the great pioneer at writing for children who are too young to sit still for a fully formed story, the kind of once upon a time tale that librarians love to tell at story hour. Her idea, she was really a poet, and I think LeVar is right in saying that that book puts into motion a ritual that a child and parent can take part in night after night. She was very attentive to the sound and rhythm of words. She liked to say that a good picture book text can almost be whistled. And she knew that children just entering the world are looking for a sense of place and a sense that they have a place in the world. And a beautifully crafted little poem like that is the literary equivalent of that place. And it becomes something that everyone becomes very attached to.
Mother Goose poems were, Mother Goose rhymes were poems in their own way. But then I guess there were much more sort of didactic or sort of moralizing stories that even very young children might have been read in the many years before Margaret Wise Brown.
Well, that's true. And they Mother Goose rhymes have something in common with Goodnight Moon. In fact, she actually alludes to a couple of them within the body of those 300 words of that brief book. But I think she came out of the Bank Street College of Education. She had studied child development. She was, as a poet, someone who had a deep emotional memory of her own childhood. And I think where Goodnight Moon goes way beyond anything that the Mother Goose rhymes have to offer is that there's an emotional center to that book. And it really feeds and responds to one of the deepest needs of very young children, which is, as I said, to have a feeling that they have a place for themselves in the world.
Leonard Marcus, LeVar Burton, it's wonderful to have both of you. Stand by. Let me take a call here, if I may, from New York. Ellen's calling. Hi, Ellen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm very interested in this discussion. Thank you, Leonard and LeVar. I represent the book, Goodnight Moon. And it's been a wonderful experience. There's over 24 million copies that have been sold
over
the years, published in 28 countries. So we have editions like Buenas Noches Luna and Bonsoir Lune and
right.
so on and so forth.
Right.
And my understanding, you know, from working with the book is that, you know, parents adore the book. Yes, children, you know, Leonard is so right about the developmental stages, but I've never represented a book where parents just bond with the book as much as the kids. You know, it's a bedtime ritual. It's almost like it feels like it's transcended being a book. It's a part of the culture, and so I'm wondering how that happened. I now have people who were read Goodnight Moon as a child who can't wait to give 5 copies to their pregnant girlfriends.
and on it goes. How do you make sense of it, Ellen? 24 million copies sold is a lot. When you read it, what do you think's going on there, the special alchemy of it?
It is alchemy. I think you're absolutely right. I think it's the music, and I think it's the bonding experience. And I want to echo what Leonard said. It's really about developmental stages, I think, in the child. It actually teaches a child to let go and go to sleep. You also find this in Margaret Wise Brown's book, The Runaway Bunny, which I think teaches a child to explore the world. You know, she was really keyed into that kind of thing. And I had a quick question for the group. I've never been able to get somebody to talk about the fact that there's so many parodies of Goodnight Moon. It's unbelievable. You know, it started with Goodnight Bush. We've got Goodnight Goon, Goodnight iPad.
Yeah, okay.
The upcoming Goodnight Nanny Cam. It's just amazing.
If
anybody has a comment about that, I'd love to know why.
I guess it's irresistible. Ellen, thank you so much for your call. It's great to hear from you. LeVar, Goodnight Nanny Cam. It may sell some copies, but I don't think, LeVar, that's going to become a classic.
Probably not. But to Ellen's other point, I think that one of the reasons why a book like Goodnight Moon, and Goodnight Moon specifically, is so popular with adults is that it actually does speak to the child within. And that's a very powerful thing to recognize, that in the reading of a book to your child, you're actually addressing your own inner child and giving something to that child that lives inside of you.
And then, of course, we had more turns in young children's literature. Dr. Seuss was there, and, of course, the great Maurice Sendak, the late legendary children's book author. his 1963 classic, Where the Wild Things Are.
The night Max wore his wolf suit and made mischief of one kind and another, his mother called him Wild Thing, and Max said, I'll eat you up. So he was sent to bed without eating anything.
From Where the Wild Things Are, Leonard Marcus, what's the turn in age? Is there one you can kind of define, or a period where you go from Goodnight Moon to this more elaborate narrative? Is it 2 years, 3 years, four? Does it depend on the child? Where is that?
Well, it does depend to some extent on the child, and it's kind of interesting to pair those two books, partly because Goodnight Moon is all about how you can find a whole world within a single room, symbolically the immediate environment that a small child who is well taken care of knows. And Where the Wild Things Are is about the child who's ready to find out what lies beyond that room, and then who ends up going to this fantastic place where he gets to show his mettle. I suppose, you know, four or five is when Where the Wild Things Are starts to make the most sense to the most kids, because they're, you know, they're beginning to feel their oats more, and they're feeling a little bit rebellious, and independence is a much bigger issue for them than it is for a 1 or 2 year old who is much more concerned about making sure that, you know, mom or dad is there to pick them up if they fall down.
LeVar Burton, you've read via television and now app, and seen so many others read over the years. How do you size up a crowd of children and think about, okay, here's what's really going to, hit their buttons, LeVar?
Yeah, well, I go to my go-to books when reading to an audience of kids. A couple of books that I encountered during our tenure with Reading Rainbow, a wonderful book called Amazing Grace. I love Enemy Pie, and Failsafe for me is Shel Silverstein poetry. Kids love Shel, and he was a master wordsmith and had an amazing sense of humor.
So do you see tastes changing in kids, or do you find them sort of timeless, LeVar? We just got you for half a minute here.
No. I think that the tastes don't change in kids. Kids love to be engaged. They love to be delighted. They love to be amused. They love things that are gross. kids. I think that they respond to the same things, generation after generation after generation.
We're going to test that theory with a librarian in a moment. And Leonard Marcus, I hope you'll stick around. Help us think about the evolution of young children's literature. LeVar Burton from Roots to Star Trek Next Generation to Reading Rainbow, and now taking Reading Rainbow right into the digital realm. What a pleasure to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining us, LeVar.
Tom, thank you. I wish I could stay. I'm on my way to speak to a group of teachers at the Q Conference here in Palm Springs, California.
Great. May it be wonderful. Thank you so much, LeVar.
God bless.
Leonard Marcus, stand by, if you would. Behind us right here, Dr. Seuss, The Cat in the Hat, a little bit of that. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
When you mislaid a certain something, keep your cool, don't go to pot.
Calculatus Eliminatus is the best friend that you've got.
Calculatus Eliminatus always helps an awful lot.
The way to find a missing something is to find out where it's not.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about young children's books, picture books, Goodnight Moon, and all the rest before and after, what we seek and share in children's literature. Of course, sometimes parents are just at the end of their rope. 2011 was a running joke for parents. American author Adam Mansbach wrote a parody children's book called Go the to Sleep, because it was taking him 2 hours every night reading to his daughter. The book went to number one on Amazon's bestseller list. Here's actor Samuel L. Jackson reading from the book.
The cats nestle close to their kittens. The lambs have laid down with the sheep. You're cozy and warm in your bed, my dear. Please go to sleep.
But much more common, parents are out there reading. Shel Silverstein's The Giving Tree, first published in 1964. It's about a female apple tree and a boy who can communicate with each other and grow old together. Half a century later, there are still over 8.5 million copies in print.
Once there was a tree, and she loved a little boy. And every day the boy would come, and he would gather her leaves and make them into crowns, and play king of the forest. He would climb up her trunk and swing from her branches and eat apples. And they would play hide-and-go-seek.
From The Giving Tree there by Shel Silverstein, Leonard Marcus has joined us from New York. He's curator of the exhibit running at the New York Public Library called The ABC of It, Why Children's Books Matter. And with us right now from Vestal, New York, is Star Latronica. She's manager of children and youth services for the 4 county public libraries in Vestal, New York, president of the Association for Library Service to Children. She's been a children's librarian for over 30 years. Star, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on, Tom. This has been a great show. I'm really enjoying it.
So are we. When they come through the door, parent and child, maybe holding hands, they come in and they ask, or they're looking. Does what they're looking for change over, Star? Do you see trends? If so, what?
Well, I think what has been touched on previously in the program is that reading is such an individual taste, so that by the time a parent and child would be coming in hand looking for books, that child has already developed those personal tastes and sense of the world that LeVar mentioned earlier on. So we really at libraries start from the time a baby's born, from babes in arms, and really sometimes even prior to that with parenting information for expectant parents on the importance of reading to your children, singing with your children, talking with your children, because we know that's really what builds vocabulary and the language, the comfort with language that will lead to those early development of literacy skills that will then turn kids into readers.
Well, let's follow your lead then. If you're suggesting books, or this is before they're even asking, you know, what are you putting out there for them, and do you see trends? Is it changing?
Well, I think the most important thing, and I think this has come back over and over today in the discussion of Goodnight Moon, is that sense of comfort of the parent with the material as well, because it's really the engagement between parent and children that make reading and language acquisition as fruitful as it can be. And so what you want to do is have books that the parents are going to enjoy reading to their children as much as anything else. And just the sound of a parent's voice and the calming nature of that lap experience that LeVar referred to, which is so very important, that's what you're going to look for. So you're going to look for books that parents are going to enjoy reading with their children. And we're so lucky now because we have tremendous board books available. So even from the earliest age, books that kids can chew on, they can literally sink their teeth into, can also provide a wonderful experience for parents and children. There's a series by Helen Oxenbury that includes a book called Clap Hands. And it's my favorite series to recommend to people because it does offer a wonderful panoply of all kinds of babies. No matter what your baby looks like, you will see your baby represented in that book. And not only that, but it features rhymes that parents can do with their kids even after they move past that book. It will become part of their family lore.
Let's listen to a little old and new here. Here's actor Owen Jordan reading from Make Way for Ducklings by Robert McCloskey. This is the book from 1941.
Mrs. Mallard stepped out across the road. Honk, honk, went the horns on the speeding cars. Quack, went Mrs. Mallard. And the cars kept speeding by and honking, and Mrs. Mallard and the ducklings kept right on quack, quack, quacking.
Fast forward 2008, a picture book, Chrysanthemum by Kevin Hanks, takes on childhood teasing and cruelties. Chrysanthemum believed her parents when they said that her name was perfect, but on her first day of kindergarten, she begins to suspect that her name, Chrysanthemum, is going to get her into trouble with other children. Here's Meryl Streep reading.
She even looks like a flower, said Victoria as Chrysanthemum entered the playground.
Let's pick her, said Rita, pointing.
Let's smell her,
said Joe. Chrysanthemum wilted. She did not think her name was absolutely perfect. She thought it was absolutely dreadful.
Chrysanthemum, 2008. Leonard Marcus, do you see trends? If parents are the ones who are going out to pick up the books and bring them home and read them, do you see trends, changes in what they are looking for, what they're bringing home to read?
Well, if you were to compare the two books you just had excerpts from, it seems to me that in earlier times, 30s and 40s, there was more focus on the child's sense of wonder and innocence. And in our time, I think children are assumed or thought to be a little bit more knowing. And there's a slightly edgier wit in some of the picture books that are being published today. For instance, the ones by Mo Willems, which are very popular and really very on target in terms of what's going on with young children. But, you know, the common thread between these older books which have survived and the new ones which are coming along that are likely to survive is that they have kind of a direct channel into the emotional life of the people they're for.
A direct channel because of their personal experience? How are they tapping that?
I think the great writers and illustrators for children remember their own childhood, and they remember what it felt like, and they also have a very keen sense of the form that they're working in.
And there they are. Of course, more knowing and more wit, but at what age do children become knowing and witty? And if they're more even, I don't know, jaded today, less naive, surely you're not at one or two. There's some threshold.
That's absolutely true. But I completely agree with Leonard that the best children's book authors and illustrators really do have a sense of an authentic sense of childhood. And although certainly we do see a lot of wit and humor, and that also becomes part of family lore, and that's why it's so important to share books with your kids from early on, because you establish that common ground and those common family inner jokes that you can share with one another. If you're eating pea soup, you can say, don't put that in your loafers, because that's what George did to spare Martha's feelings. So it's really, it is one of those things that develops gradually, just as children develop gradually. And as they see more of the world, their interest in the world expands. And so it is a cycle that is never ending.
And reference points that let you go back and also push out from that pool of light by the bed. Helen in Virginia Beach, Virginia, thank you for calling, Helen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a 10-year-old boy who amazes me every day, and reading is a big part of our life. But what I wanted to say was that he has such a healthy sense of curiosity, and I know that comes from reading. And I think that a lot of, the healthy eating campaign, there it really is a public campaign going on about reading more to your child. But I caution, parents not to read for fluency, which a lot of parents are doing because they want to make sure, but to read for meaning and, explore the text, let them analyze it, let them, tell you about the characters and the landscape and
have some freedom with it, not turn it into a drilling session, Helen.
What I see happening a lot is that a lot of kids want their parents want their children to meet that benchmark. And in order to meet that benchmark, they need such great fluency. But in trying to strive for fluency, you're not letting them explore the text like they need to.
Yeah, don't turn a picture book into studying for an exam. Blessedly, that's at least a little ways down the road. Helen, I appreciate your call. I want to hear a little more of the old style and not quite as old style. This is a kid's child's tale recorded in 1958, an old woman sweeping her house. It's from she's trying to get home with a pig she bought at the market. The pig won't jump over the stile. She recruits a dog to punish the pig. The dog, too, won't do what she asks. You can hear how this story is more about obedience and disobedience than about mischief, just a little less joyous than the newer children's literature beginning to come out at around the same time.
So she said to the dog, "Dog, dog, bite pig. Pig won't go over the stile, and I shan't get home tonight." But the dog would not. She went a little farther, and she met a stick. So she said, Stick, stick, beat dog. Dog won't bite pig, pig won't get over the stile, and I shan't get home tonight. But the stick would not.
And somehow that stick is out there. The threat of some disciplining is somehow comes with the book. You get to 1962. Here's an online interactive adaptation. Dr. Seuss's The Sleep Book, the story of the whole wide world, including you or your child, goes to sleep at night. And all starts with one contagious yawn from a tiny little bug.
The news just came in from the county of Keck that a very small bug by the name of Van Vleck is yawning so wide you can look down his neck. This may not seem very important, I know, but it is, so I'm bothering telling you so.
Leonard Marcus, that sense of fun and ease that came with Dr. Seuss was just remarkable. Of course, Theodor Geisel, are we still on some kind of arc of change in terms of what's showing up in the books that people really cotton to, Leonard?
Well, you know, Dr. Seuss was one of the masters of playing with words. And I think that was a wonderful thing to show children, that the language that they, you know, start to have some mastery of from the time they're very young is really one of their greatest toys. And that thinking at its best, and, you know, any great scientist will tell you this, is playful in its essence. So I that's a tradition that we continue to see people working in, and I think it's probably one of the most enlightened sides of children's literature.
Thinking as play, I just love that. Let me go to Dorothy in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Dorothy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention that my daughter, my oldest, when she was only probably about 1.5, she was just starting to learn how to speak in sentences. We read the Dr. Seuss book, Are You My Mother?
Sure.
And there's the one page where the baby bird becomes completely distraught. I think it's where the crane is there. And the baby bird realizes this is not his mother. And he says, "You are not my mother. Where is my mother? I want to go home." And our daughter would become completely empathetic at that point and say the word home, 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 over and over. I can hardly tell it without getting tears in my eyes because it was so precious. And I thought that was one of the best values of that book, that it taught empathy and just the value of that parent-child relationship.
The emotional connection right there. We hear it just in your telling, Dorothy. I appreciate that. I mean, Star, there's so much modeling here. The child, it's not just letters on a page. It's not even just the words that are read, but them observing the parent's reaction to what they're communicating.
Absolutely. And I think we've touched on this a couple times during this conversation because it really is the universal theme of sharing books with children, is the engagement, is that bonding that happens between the parent and the child or the caregiver and the child. And that really is what opens a child's heart up and a child's mind up into learning and moving forward and taking those developmental steps. They have that security. They have that familiarity. And I think that's part of the magic of Goodnight Moon, again, is it builds that security, that pattern, and that familiarity, because the world of a young child is ever-changing and completely unpredictable. But to have that experience with an adult through a book, and then to carry it on, as Helen mentioned with her son, that here at age 10, they're still sharing books and they're conversing about books, which is just wonderful to hear. And as Dorothy mentioned, the whole way of creating empathy and learning compassion through experiencing other people's adventures on a page is a priceless gift that you can give your child.
Leonard Marcus, here we are, 2014, and Margaret Wise Brown work out in front of us again. When do we break through this color issue and put it behind us? When do people of color become fully represented in the thousands of new children's books that come out every year, Leonard? What's the tipping point?
It's been a really long struggle, and America hasn't really come to grips with this with any ease. Back in 1920, the NAACP started a magazine for African-American children called The Brownies Book. It only lasted 2 years. Langston Hughes, the great poet, published his very first poem in that magazine. But America wasn't ready for it. We're still struggling to get to that point. I think we've made some progress, though.
Well, it's been fascinating to explore today with the two of you and LeVar Burton earlier, Leonard Marcus. So great to have you with us. You're so generous with your time and insights. Thank you very much for joining us, Leonard.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Starletronica with the Four County Public Libraries in Vestal, New York. Star, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Just a little more here. This is the book, The Pout Pout Fish, by Deborah Deason, chosen by Time Magazine as a top 10 children's book 2008. One fan of the book, parent Gordon True, adapted the story to music, posted it himself to YouTube, and on go the stories. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
She is squirmy, she is squelchy, she is slightly impolite. Hey, Mr. Fish, you kaleidoscope a mope. How about a smile, a little joy, a little hope? Said the fish to his friend, Miss Squid, I would try, but I haven't any choice. Take a look and you'll see why. I'm a pout-pout fish with a pout-pout face, so I spread the jerry-werries all over.